Welcome to the debate. So imagine a multi-million-dollar eco-resort that wins, pretty much every global sustainability award available.
Oh, right. The classic green utopia.
Exactly. It has solar panels on the roof, zero-waste kitchens, and carbon offset certificates framed right there in the lobby.
Sounds perfect.
On paper, yeah. According to conventional metrics, it is an absolute triumph of green development. But underneath the surface, its massive daily water consumption is quietly draining the local town's drinking aquifer dry.
Yeah, which is a total nightmare. And that massive gap, the space between a seemingly flawless, abstract policy blueprint and the messy living reality of the physical site. That is exactly the threshold we are exploring today.
Right, because for decades we've treated policy as if a perfectly drawn map just automatically forces the territory to change.
Which it never does.
No, it really doesn't. So today we are unpacking a newly released academic white paper from Dr. Bichara Saheli. It's titled Life Coherent Transition: A Mascarona-Informed Stakeholder Engagement Framework.
Quite a title.
It is, yeah. But the paper tackles this exact crisis, right? How societies can finally shift away from abstract, often destructive economic metrics like unmoored GDP or endless tourism throughput, and return to what the author calls the life ground.
The life ground, right.
Yeah, the foundational set of conditions that actually make life possible. We are talking about the physical reality of water, soil, community health, and, public trust.
Right. And Dr. Saheli's paper posits a really profound central thesis to solve this. She argues that a true life-coherent transition requires both the precision of right distinction and the humility of right relation.
Yeah, those are the two pillars.
Exactly. But the core intellectual tension we are wrestling with today is which of these two pillars is the actual primary driver of genuine transformation.
Right. And I will be arguing that true transformation relies primarily on right relation, organic, co-designed structural coupling with stakeholders, because top-down technical instructions just fundamentally fail to change human systems.
And I will be arguing that without the uncompromising technical precision of right distinction, and by that, I mean strict institutional guardrails and hard life capital budgeting, relational approaches will inevitably be captured, diluted, and turned into symbolic branding by entrenched powers.
Okay, so let's unpack the foundation of this, because the paper leans heavily on the late biologist Humberto Maturana.
Yeah, his biology of cognition is the philosophical bedrock here.
Right. Maturana taught us that living systems, and, by extension, human societies and institutions, are structurally determined.
Which sounds dense, but it's crucial.
It is. And I want to translate what that means for policy, because it changes, well, everything. In biology, it means an organism and its environment shape each other over time, like a river carving a canyon and the canyon directing the river.
Right.
You can't just drop a concrete dam into that dynamic and expect the water to peacefully obey, right? It will find a way around or build up pressure and just break the dam.
Yeah, because the environment can perturb the system, but it cannot explicitly instruct it to change its fundamental nature on command.
Exactly. Information, data, policy frameworks, they can perturb a system, but they cannot instruct it. A brilliant new environmental policy document doesn't get downloaded into a farmer's or a finance minister's brain like an iPhone software update.
Ha, if only.
Right? They respond to it based entirely on their own internal structure, their history, and the systemic pressures they face every day. This is why the conventional policy approach of designing a master plan in the capital city and then going on a tour to seek buy-in is just a fundamental failure of implementation. You are treating humans like programmable machines.
Look, I don't deny the elegance of Maturana's biological framework, but we have to be incredibly careful here. The source material explicitly warns us against letting this become a free-floating abstraction or falling into rhetorical dilution.
Okay, so what does rhetorical dilution look like in this context, in your view?
Well, it looks like what happened to the word sustainable or regenerative.
Oh, yeah.
Right? These were vital ecological concepts that have been completely hollowed out by corporate and political interests. If you rely primarily on relational praxis, you know, just getting everyone in a room to co-create and couple with each other, you just end up with pleasant town halls where existing power structures simply learn the new vocabulary.
You think they just co-opt the language?
Absolutely. They adopt the language of the transition just so they can rebrand their extractive practices without making a single actual structural sacrifice. The primary engine of change has to be strict technical architecture. The paper calls this renesting.
Right, renesting. Let's make sure we clarify that mechanism because it's so central to the paper.
Yeah, so renesting essentially means updating the operating system of our society so that the economy runs inside the environment's hard drive rather than the other way around.
Right, grounding it in the life ground.
Exactly. Currently, abstract systems like finance and global markets dominate the life support systems they're supposed to serve. To fix that, you need hard boundaries. That is the very purpose of what Saheli calls the life capital test and life capital budgeting.
But, I mean, my pushback is that renesting cannot happen by decree. You can't just legislate an operating system update and expect the hardware not to crash.
But it cannot happen without hard boundaries either. Think about it mathematically.
Okay.
If a resort generates $10 million in revenue, but its operations deplete $15 million worth of aquifer resilience and local health outcomes, the budget is negative.
Right. The real world budget.
Exactly. The society is subsidizing the resort's private profit with its own life ground. Unless you had the uncompromising technical precision of a life capital test to force that math into the light and stop the project, your co-ownership easily devolves into participation as mere symbolism.
Well, but look at the reality of how institutions actually behave when you hit them with a strict technical test. This brings us to a really crucial question. How do we interpret stakeholder resistance?
Okay.
When a new strict life-coherent policy is introduced, resistance is basically guaranteed. And the immediate instinct of the policymaker is to view that resistance as an enemy to be defeated. But I argue that stakeholder resistance is rarely irrational and it is almost never malicious. It is structural.
Structural meaning they are bound by their current mandates.
Exactly. Sally argues that stakeholders must be treated as legitimate worlds of concern. Let's take a Ministry of Finance.
Sure.
If they resist a transformative ecological investment, say a massive shift toward decentralized solar grids, it isn't because the civil servants there hate ecology.
No, obviously not.
Right. It is because they are structurally mandated to conserve cash flow, maintain national debt credibility, and, you know, meet the public payroll. Their conserved concern is macroeconomic stability. If you just wave a life capital test in their face and tell them they are failing the life ground, they will reject you.
And I would argue that macroeconomic stability is a perfectly legitimate structural concern until the pursuit of it begins to degrade the very life support systems the entire macroeconomy rests on.
I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective. Think of resistance not as a brick wall, but as a diagnostic dashboard light.
A dashboard light?
Yeah. It's a signal showing us exactly where our framework hasn't successfully coupled with a stakeholder's conserved concerns. When we see that resistance, our job isn't to force the policy through with a mandate. Our job is to translate the life-coherent distinction into their world.
Uh-huh.
For the finance ministry, we have to sit down and reframe ecological repair not as a moral imperative, but as reducing hidden liabilities and future infrastructural repair costs. We have to show them how regenerative practices actually protect the sovereign debt rating over a 20-year horizon.
I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that. Let me tell you why.
Okay.
I hear the logic in that, but I think that sounds like a massive loophole. You are treating all resistance as if it is merely a miscommunication, you know, a failure to properly translate the concept.
Well, a failure to couple structurally.
But the text explicitly states the legitimacy of the other does not mean the legitimacy of life-destructive patterns. Let's be honest about human incentives here. Some resistance absolutely does protect privilege, opacity, and extraction.
It protects a structural advantage, sure, because that's how the system currently rewards them.
It protects extraction. Let's go back to the tourism sector. A massive corporate hotel operator might resist new, strict water use regulations. They will tell you their concern is maintaining high occupancy rates, keeping shareholder confidence, and providing jobs.
Which are real concerns for them.
Right, and that sounds very legitimate in a boardroom. But if we endlessly accommodate every stakeholder's conserved concern in the name of relational harmony, we will never forcefully regulate extractive practices.
But
we will never stop the excessive aquifer depletion or the mass importation of ultra-processed foods that are driving up preventable diseases in the local population. At some point, if you don't want the society to collapse, the life capital test has to act as a hard wall. The blueprint has to have teeth.
But if you just hit them with a hard wall, what actually happens? They don't suddenly become enlightened ecologists.
Well,
they hire lobbyists to work around it, they find a legal loophole, or they threaten capital flight and panic the politicians into dropping the test entirely. You cannot regulate a mindset away.
So what is the alternative? Just endless dialogue while the aquifer runs dry?
No, the alternative is bypassing the defensive wall entirely. This is why CA leans so heavily on experiential change, which brings us to the paper's concept of visible pilots, or what she calls embodied perturbations.
Okay, right?
You don't just announce a new regenerative era from a podium in the Capitol. You build a living demonstration of a possible world.
Right, the experiential aspect.
Because change happens experientially. Take the Green-Blue Youth Corps, detailed in the text.
Yeah, that's a good example.
Typically, a struggling municipality might view unemployed youth as a risk, like a liability to be managed or policed, and they view environmental degradation as a cost they can't afford to fix. The pilot program flips both.
Right.
Instead of treating young people as risks, you hire them as paid co-builders. You pay them to restore degraded coastlines, to install community solar, or to map urban water leaks. When a skeptical mayor or a defensive hotelier actually sees a teenager fixing a neighborhood block and improving the local ecosystem, the theoretical fear of wasted budget just vanishes.
Because they can see the tangible output.
Exactly. Or, you know, consider farmer-hotel procurement agreements. Instead of mandating that a hotel buy a local, you create a pilot where the hotel commits to buying a specific tonnage of local produce at a fair price for just one season.
Just as a test.
Yeah. The chef realizes the quality is better. The farmer gets capital to expand. These pilot programs bypass theoretical resistance by letting stakeholders literally touch, taste, and experience the new reality. It creates a physical, emotional reality that a spreadsheet or a punitive regulation just never could. It proves the transition is viable.
That's a compelling argument. But have you considered the guardrails Saheli explicitly warns about regarding this exact mechanism?
Which ones?
The author specifically warns of the risk of pilots without structural change. A pilot is practically useless and sometimes even harmful if it remains an isolated event.
Harmful? Wait, how could a successful pilot be harmful?
Because it creates the illusion of systemic progress while the underlying extractive machine just keeps humming along. Let's look at the mechanics of it. Say an NGO comes in with grant money and builds a beautiful solarized community clinic.
Okay, great.
It's wonderful. It lowers the energy bill. It provides reliable care. It looks fantastic on a philanthropic brochure. But what happens when the grant money runs out?
Well,
unless these pilots are immediately tied to systemic institutionalization, meaning you actually change national procurement laws and you legally lock those energy savings into mandatory maintenance budgets at the state level, they remain stage demonstrations. They are just pet projects, completely disconnected from the everyday operating reality of the nation.
I'm not convinced by that line of reasoning, because living systems require emotioning. I really struggled with this part of your argument, the demand for immediate systemic mandates. I think it ignores the biological reality of how living systems adapt. How so?
It all comes back to what Maturana calls emotioning. The text tells us that every rational policy domain rests on an emotional domain. If you try to force strict compliance and systemic mandates too early, before the system has actually experienced the alternative, you generate fear, defensiveness, and resentment. The old system just tightens its grip.
But without the mandate, the old system doesn't have to change at all. But pilots aren't just technical experiments to gather data.
They generate the grounded hope necessary for systemic laws to even be accepted in the first place. You cannot mandate a structural shift in national food procurement if the local farmers and the corporate chefs don't trust each other yet. The pilot builds the trust builds the relational coupling, and then the system is ready to encode that into law.
I mean, hope without a mandate is just a temporary relief from a permanent problem. And this really forces us to look at how we evaluate success. If we are going to rely on your relational praxis in these localized pilots, how do we know we are actually succeeding systemically?
We measure it through what the paper calls shared seeing.
Right, which challenges traditional metrics.
The SIS. For a listener who might find that term dense, let's unpack it. It essentially challenges the arrogant idea that an expert observer, like an economist or an engineer, can stand completely outside a system, look at it objectively, and declare what is true for everyone.
Right.
Saheli argues that the Life Coherent dashboard shouldn't be an expert surveillance tool used to punish ministries or grade communities. It has to be a tool for mutual learning.
Meaning you incorporate the subjective experience.
Yes. We have to recognize that lived narratives are just as vital as quantitative metrics on a spreadsheet.
Okay, but...
Wait, let me just give an example. A water engineer might look at the reservoir volume and the pumping pressure and declare, we have 90% capacity, the system is performing perfectly.
Right.
But the household resident turns on their tap and gets brown water. Or no water at all, because the localized neighborhood piping has completely degraded. If the engineer claims pure, absolute objectivity based on their macro data, they completely invalidate the resident's reality. The quantitative metric without the qualitative narrative is a lie.
I come at it from a different way. I understand the epistemology there, and the lived narrative is vital context, absolutely. But it simply cannot replace objective accounting.
But it's not replacing it.
We can't manage public infrastructure or national ecological survival purely on anecdotes. We are talking about measuring hidden liabilities, things like rising rates of preventable diabetes due to imported food, the deferred maintenance of an electrical grid, or the slow, invisible salinization of an underground aquifer. Measuring those things requires brutal, objective technical accounting.
But the qualitative storytelling from the community tells you why the numbers are what they are and how they're impacting daily life.
Yes, but the hard numbers tell you if the society is fundamentally surviving. The paper clearly states that conventional indicators like GDP and tourism arrivals must be re-nested.
Yes.
That requires holding political leadership and massive economic sectors strictly quantitatively accountable to whether life capital is being depleted or regenerated over time. Without technical supremacy in measurement, without a dashboard that clearly flashes red when we are drawing down our ecological and social inheritance, we invite what the paper calls capture by existing power.
But how does a dashboard prevent capture?
Because the powerful will always be able to tell a beautiful qualitative story about how well things are going. A highly extractive corporation will happily engage in shared seeing town halls and spin a narrative about community partnerships while quietly draining the aquifer. We need the technical dashboard immune to storytelling to cut through the branding and say, no, the water level dropped by 2 meters this year. You fail the test.
Look, the dashboard is essential. I grant you that. But if it lacks public narrative, it fails to guide collective understanding. Let me explain the mechanical risk here.
Sure.
If a civil servant is simply handed a new set of life capital indicators and told to report on them to a central authority, it just becomes a bureaucratic compliance exercise. That is what Saheli warns about as the risk of dashboards as bureaucracy. Shared seeing means the community and the experts interpret the data together.
It fuses the two realities.
Exactly. When the engineer and the household resident look at the water leakage data together, the engineer provides the technical scope, the what and the where, but the resident provides the lived impact, the how and the why it matters. That synthesis is where co-ownership is born. It ceases to be the government's water problem, and it becomes our water problem.
I don't disagree that mutual learning is the ideal state of a healthy society, but I keep coming back to the paper's warning about misnesting and the sheer momentum of the status quo.
Yeah.
When abstract systems, like maximizing short-term financial returns or obsessing over tourism throughput, come to dominate the life support systems they're meant to serve, the society enters a structural inversion.
The economy eats the host.
Precisely. And To reverse that, to enact true re-nesting, requires immense friction. You are asking systems, corporations, and political entities that have been highly rewarded for decades for acting extractively to suddenly subordinate themselves to the civil commons. They will not do that willingly just because they had a good conversation with a farmer.
Which is exactly why you need the relational praxis spiral. You can't just command them to stop. You have to listen for their conserved concerns, translate the life-coherent distinctions into a language they understand, and co-design the practical interventions so they can see a pathway to survive the transition. If you try to force a massive re-nesting through technical supremacy and hard dashboards alone, the societal body will reject it like a mismatched organ transplant. Living systems cannot be instructed into regeneration. They must be invited, perturbed, and engaged in recurrent, respectful coordination over time.
They must be perturbed, yes. But the perturbation must carry the weight of an uncrossable boundary. If the life capital test doesn't have actual teeth, if there is no legal or economic penalty for failing it, then the relational spiral just goes round and round in endless polite conversation. And while we are talking, the life ground continues to be degraded.
This is the exact tension at the heart of the framework, and I think we're arriving at the core synthesis of Dr. Saheeli's work.
I think so too.
For my part, I look at the philosophy of a life coherent transition and see a fundamentally human, existentially relational challenge. We have decades of failed environmental policies to prove that the most brilliant technical framework will just hover above reality if it isn't grounded in human connection. Without recognizing stakeholders as legitimate worlds, without honoring their conserved concerns, and without utilizing the relational praxis spiral to build grounded hope through visible pilots, the blueprint is just a free-floating abstraction. It might look mathematically perfect on paper, but it will fail entirely to change the structural coupling of the real world.
And coming from the other side, while I agree that relational harmony and mutual learning are vital to the human experience, the actual physical survival of the transition depends entirely on right distinction. Human systems are masterful at self-deception and preserving comfort. Without the uncompromising technical boundaries of the life capital test, life capital budgeting, and rigorous objective dashboarding to continually diagnose and correct misnesting, relational praxis is simply too vulnerable. It will be co-opted, diluted, and utilized as symbolic branding to maintain the extractive status quo while feeling good about it.
Yet, despite our different angles of approach, I think we both clearly see the brilliance of Dr. Saheeli's ultimate thesis here. A truly beautiful, life-coherent world isn't an either-or proposition. It demands both precision and humility.
It absolutely does. The framework accurately diagnoses why so much modern policy fails. You cannot simply hand down an expert blueprint and demand compliance. That ignores human biology and social trust. You desperately need the technical rigor of the life capital metrics to ensure you are actually regenerating the physical world. But you equally need the Maturana-informed relational engagement to ensure that people are willing to build it with you.
Holding those two forces in tension is what makes this framework so revolutionary. It asks us to be fiercely uncompromising in our defense of the life ground, our water, our soil, our health, but deeply humble in how we invite others into that defense. There is a vast amount of depth to explore within the Life Coherence Knowledge Commons on this topic, and we've really only scratched the surface of the mechanisms today.
It is a dense, deeply rewarding text that forces you to completely rethink what it means to enact public policy and engage with your community.
We will leave it to you, our listeners, to ponder how you might apply these concepts, both the strict protective guardrails and the relational humility, in your own institutions and neighborhoods. Because ultimately, an architectural blueprint, no matter how mathematically flawless, is just ink on a page until we step out onto the uneven soil, face the unpredictable weather, and decide to build the house together.